Arizona and the country have been adding jobs. Forecasts suggest that could continue. But there are questions about what kinds of jobs are coming.
Where do we want to be in 20 years? Do we want to be back to where we were in 2005, or do we want to be much more on the edge of a new economy?
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Governor Ducey releases his budget proposal for the new fiscal year, where reality and media meet in overturning wrongful convictions.
Some Valley guide dogs hit the books.
And unpacking the work of a master.
Do you think that most people who come to the art museum and see an exhibit like this know how much has gone into just how they display it?
I think they have no idea.
Plus, Gilbert's looking to build a really big park, and we take a trip in the time machine.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Partly cloudy skies will stay with us for the rest of this afternoon. We're expecting to reach a high around 61 degrees. And then for tonight, we should be mostly clear with lows in the lower 40s. And then partly cloudy skies over the weekend with a high of 63 tomorrow and then 67 degrees on Sunday. Currently partly cloudy, only 56 degrees at KJZZ.
If you're headed up to the Flagstaff area this weekend to play in the snow, you won't be the only one. As KJZZ's Stina Sieg reports, the Arizona Department of Transportation is warning of likely heavy congestion on the roadways.
ADOT spokesman Steve Elliott says it's likely for three reasons: good snow, a three-day weekend, and history. ADOT often reports heavy snowplow traffic this time of year. But Elliott says that doesn't mean you shouldn't go.
Well, I might want to make a snowman this weekend. I'm not sure. One thing I might do if I go up there is consider coming back a little earlier. What we have seen is that around 4 and 4:30, when the snowplow areas begin to close, that's when the congestion is the heaviest. So if you are going up there, you might consider making an earlier start.
Elliott cautions that while it might be tempting, never pull off on the side of a highway to play in the snow, and wait until you reach a designated parking area. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Although many Valley residents may have found last week's persistent rain annoying, it already is starting to ease the state's drought conditions. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Andrew Bernier reports.
The Phoenix branch of the National Weather Service is reporting for the first time in 5 years no areas of the state are under severe drought. From just the rainfall last week, much of southern and northeastern Arizona show no drought conditions, while eastern, central, and western parts of the state show abnormally dry to moderate drought conditions. Compared to this time last year, more than 80% of the state was either in moderate to severe drought. Across the greater Southwest, about half of the land is covered in snow, while only one-third of it was at this time last year. In Phoenix, I'm Andrew Bernier, KJZZ News.
Governor Doug Ducey unveiled his more than $9 billion budget proposal this afternoon. Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times has been going through the plan and joins me. Jeremy, what are some of the highlights?
Well, I think the most notable thing that stands about this budget is it really keeps the spending increases modest. And this is something we've been hearing from the governor and from legislative leaders for a while now. As last year, we saw these massive cuts to universities and a lot of other areas as the state grappled with this big budget crisis. This year, we've got $200, $250 million in extra money to spend, and the governor is committed to not spending much of that. We've got about $284 million in new spending, but less than half of that is more than half of that is one-time spending. I think there's only about $32 million in ongoing permanent new spending that isn't already required by law, as opposed to things like inflation-based funding increases for K-12. He's trying to hold the line on spending, and this really followed through on kind of the pledge he'd made in the State of the State to do that.
So of that amount of money for sort of permanent ongoing expenses, where is that money going?
Some of that money is going to K-12. A small amount of that is going to Department of Child Safety. Some of that is going to the governor's new border strike force. A little bit to universities, far less than they wanted. Remember, they took a $99 million cut last year. They're asking for $24 million of those cuts to be restored, and about $76 million in funding for a new type of funding model. What they're getting ultimately is $8 million for that funding model, which is really going to focus on in-state students and does not restore most of those cuts that were made from last year.
Governor Ducey has talked a lot about cutting taxes every year that he is in office. He talked about it again on Monday in his State of the State. Did he outline in this budget proposal which taxes he might be looking to cut this year?
No, and that was, I would say, definitely the most glaring omission from this budget, is it did not include any figures for, you know, kind of revenue losses from tax cuts or any deep information about even what kind of tax cut we might see. What the governor's office has said to us is, you know, he'll be working with the legislature throughout the 2016 session on that issue. So we're going to have to wait for the details for that.
Jeremy, very quickly before I let you go, any sense that of the response that this proposal is getting from the legislature?
All we've seen so far is statements from Senate President Biggs and House Speaker Gowan, which were released as part of a press release from the governor's office. They were both very, needless to say, kind of effusive in their praise for the governor's budget. You know, last year we saw an almost unprecedented amount of cooperation between the three of them on the budget. This early signal kind of shows that, everyone is on the same page. Senate President Biggs had very much kind of taken the same line on holding and keeping spending low. And it looks like all three of them are kind of working in tandem right now.
Jeremy Duda covers the governor's office for the Arizona Capital Times. We were talking about Governor Ducey's budget proposal that he released today. Jeremy, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
The U.S. Labor Department reported this month that the country added nearly 300,000 non-farm jobs in December. In November, state officials say Arizona added almost 30,000 such positions. So what does 2016 look like? For answers, we turn to Laurent Baudu. He heads Greenberg Traurig's Phoenix Office's Employment and Labor Practice Group. Laurent, do you think the start of this year will be as good as the end of last one?
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily going to be as good, but certainly, if you look at the recent trend, the numbers would bear out that we're going to continue seeing those same kind of patterns.
Are there particular industries nationally and here in Arizona that folks should expect to see more jobs added in?
I think in Arizona, what we'd like to see, and I don't know how quickly that's going to go, but I think there still is a decent demand in construction. Services continue to be on the uptick. But some of the key metrics, some of the things that really made the numbers jump, are not necessarily as significantly represented here. So I think we're going to see some of it, but I think what we should try to take stock of is the fact that one of the largest growing areas is going to be in the tech sector. And I think that's something that that is not something that's going to happen in one quarter. That's a process which will ultimately help bear fruit. But in the first quarter, it's too soon for any of that stuff to materialize.
One of the concerns that a lot of folks raise when they're talking about job growth, especially in Arizona, is the quality of the jobs. Are these well-paying, high-skilled jobs that come with benefits, or are they sort of low-hourly, service-type jobs? What are you seeing as far as that goes coming up?
That hits the nerve of what was the central point, I think, of this report. You saw a significant amount of growth in the industry, in the job market overall. But there are two key issues that I think are slightly problematic. Stagnation in terms of the wages. And the other component is the ratio of potentially working people versus actually working people or seeking a job. We're under 70% in that particular category. But the other one is the stagnation of wages. I think where you saw the pickup was in sectors where the wages are relatively low and do not necessarily carry those benefits that you're talking about.
Arizona's unemployment rate has sort of stubbornly stayed higher than the national one. Do you expect those to come back into balance or more into balance this year?
Look, you have 50 states, so you're going to have some deviations in all of them. A large component of our economy has been for a long time the real estate and construction market. So obviously that is still trailing well below the levels that we were at in 2007. So inherently, I think it's logical that we'd be a little bit behind the national trend. And I don't think that's something that's going to overturn itself or correct itself overnight. I think the initiatives that we have to try to modernize our workforce in Arizona are necessary, and ultimately down the road, are going to bear fruit, where we're likely in the next 5 to 10 years, if I'm an optimist, I would say that, you're going to see those numbers hopefully reverse themselves.
Yeah, do you think that Arizona can really fully rebound absent sort of a diversifying of its workforce portfolio?
Rebound, yes. But do you want to be the preferred destination for jobs over the next generation, 20, 25 years? I think that's where you have to look at. So can we rebound? And look, we have what we've always had. As you can tell from the accent, I wasn't born here. I came here by choice for obvious reasons to me. And anybody who makes their decision to live in Arizona, there are some very clear reasons why. To me, I think we could just have an immediate rebound, but it's as a group here, as the totality of the state and certainly Southern Arizona, where do we want to be in 20 years? Do we want to be back to where we were in 2005, or do we want to be much more on the edge of a new economy? I mean, it's interesting, it's coming here, we're just looking at GE relocating its headquarters to Boston. And that's a prime example. They've invested a lot in redeveloping the tech sector. They have a massive infrastructure around the Boston area for that. And I think that's the same kind of potting that we want to try to create here, where we've recently were deemed to be one of the great places to have a tech startup. That's the type of stuff that we want to build on for 20, 25 years.
Laurent Badu is a shareholder at the law firm Greenberg Traurig and head of the Phoenix office's Employment and Labor Practice Group.
A group of Valley couriers is suing Amazon, alleging they were misclassified as independent contractors, even though their clothing had Amazon Prime Now on it and they worked fixed hours from an Amazon warehouse. Other recent suits involving strippers, among others, have also been filed because conflicts over the definition of employee versus independent contractor. Mary Ann Jennings, professor emeritus at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU, joins me now to talk about the trend. Are we, in fact, seeing more of these cases now?
It's a growing trend. In fact, I was just teaching in an executive program in Texas, and it's really interesting. I've taught in this program for 10 years, and these are manufacturers' reps, and they have a lot of salespeople who work for them strictly on commission. And 10 years ago, I used to caution them about the risks of classifying those folks as independent contractors versus employees because, you know, the wage taxes and all of that. And I would ask, how many of you have independent contractors? And 10 years ago, it was the whole room. And I asked it just 2 days ago and said, okay, how many of you have independent contractors versus salespeople? And it was probably out of a group of about 90, there were probably 8 that had independent contractors. And the reason for that is the IRS has targeted this.
Though 8 out of 90 is a small percentage, why would those 8, for example, still hold on to that then?
One of the things that's really a killer for classifying them as an independent contractor is if all of their money comes from a single source. That's one of the first things that the IRS looks at. You know, is this their only source of income? The IRS has kind of taken the position that a true independent contractor is somebody like an outside consultant that you hire to help in your business. And then, but they also work for other businesses. That's a true independent contractor. Another thing that they look at is the degree of control that they exercise over them. So if, for example, you have a salesperson who does not work out of your office, but works out of his or her home and pays for a phone and those kinds of things, and you don't control their schedule, that's going to be a little easier to classify as an independent contractor. So the 8 or 9 that are still hanging on to independent contractor, they may have salespeople who actually work for different companies.
How about as it relates to the sharing economy? Uber has gotten praise in some circles for some of its practices, but Uber's had issues as far as this independent contracting goes. So it's interesting to see sort of a trendy, more high-tech company running into this.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, people have to understand it's kind of a trade-off. If you truly are a 1099er, then you absorb all of the expenses and everything. But in theory, it should be this way if they're truly independent. You know, you set your own schedule, you set your own hours, you take care of your own taxes, all of those kinds of things. And it is a lot cheaper for the company to do it that way. But some people want that stability. You take out my taxes. You pay the unemployment. You pay my Social Security. They want all of that, but that is almost destructive to the business model. And so what we're looking at here is, you know, the push of the IRS and these new business models that are based on, look, we can give you this freedom. You know, you can work as much as you want, as little as you want. It's your call.
Are there ethics and ethical questions that arise for you in this?
I think one of the first ones, and I always explain this to them, the reason they get into trouble is because somebody's terminated. They come back against them and say, hey, you know, I should have been paid this. I should have been done that. I was truly an employee. So then they end up owing a lot of taxes and things. My advice to people is to always just lay it out in front. Look, this is the way this is structured. These are your responsibilities, so that they can make that choice. And that if they're looking for something that has the stability and the sure thing and the paycheck and all of that, they need a different type of business. And so it's the upfront disclosure, because a lot of people really aren't understanding all of the issues of truly being an independent contractor.
Mary Ann Jennings is Professor Emeritus at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU.
Coming up, how does your garden grow? Learn how to turn rainwater into an irrigation system.
In a good rain like we had last night, there's a waterfall coming off the roof right here. You put a barrel, it fills up fast.
We won't spill a drop. That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It is the show on 91.5 KJZZ. In Valley traffic, an accident, I-17 southbound at 7th Avenue has that off-ramp restricted. Also a collision blocking the HOV lane of the 60 eastbound at Rural. It'll stay partly cloudy this afternoon. We're expecting a high of 61. Currently under partly cloudy skies, it's 58 degrees at 220.
KJZZ is supported by El Encanto, providing the sights, sounds, and taste of Mexico for 25 years, with restaurants in Cave Creek, Desert Hills, and Fountain Hills, lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, weddings, and large events. ElEncantoRestaurants.com.
It's the show for Friday, January 15th. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. The World Health Organization had a, quote, mission accomplished moment this week.
Hours after officials at the WHO declared a final end to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, a new death from Ebola was reported in Sierra Leone.
More than 11,300 people were killed last year in the outbreak, and officials are hoping that experience helps them in containing this incident.
Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. This isn't just a little mistake, is it?
Unfortunately, that appears to be the case, John. I've talked to some people on the ground there. And in this particular case, the woman who was infected with the Ebola virus traveled through several districts of Sierra Leone, at least three, went to a hospital, was treated, was not diagnosed at the time, was then discharged, sent home, after which she passed away. And her family was allowed to wash her in the ritual manner, which was at the very root of the spread of the Ebola virus more than a year ago. So it appears to be a case now where public health workers on the ground there will have a lot of people to be monitoring. It really reopens Ebola in Sierra Leone in a scary way.
Are they bracing for a number that they're putting on a whiteboard of how many further infections there might be if they get particularly unlucky here?
Well, you know, it's this kind of exponential thing, and so you really have to watch it. In this case, the good news is they know the index case, where it all begins, very quickly after the death, and they can begin the process of figuring out how much contact she had with other individuals, and they will continue to track them. But it opens up this, you know, period of time. At least 42 days, there's a 21-day incubation period for Ebola, so at least 42 days to declare that the people she had contact with are in fact not infected by Ebola. But the insidious thing about Ebola and the thing that has been bothering public health workers is they have discovered Ebola in the semen of men who have survived the virus. And they just don't know how long the Ebola virus can lurk in that context. And so that opens up all kinds of possibilities for this kind of latent time bomb of Ebola spread.
Are doctors saying it's conceivable that Ebola could be a sexually transmitted disease?
It is conceivable. It hasn't been proven, but that is the concern, that it can stay in the semen. And what is not known is if it somehow can be spread as well by the woman. And if that is the case, that opens up a whole new dimension to Ebola. You know, the good news for all this is that the vaccine trials are going well. And if the world can get behind the idea of mass vaccinations there when the time is right, that will go a long way to stopping these Ebola outbreaks from turning into what we saw last year.
Trolling for some other good news here, is it possible that because of the so recent experience in all of these West African nations, that even a small incident that has a potential of being much larger, when you sound the alarm, people really listen and cooperate, unlike what was the case in the early going when the Ebola virus outbreak began last year?
Absolutely. I mean, that spread went a long way before the world really mobilized. You know, what you have is a dysfunctional healthcare network in that part of the world. These are the poorest countries in the world. And so Ebola spread quickly and the world did not mobilize fast enough. And I think we can say even today, even after the horrible irony of having this crop up the day after they declare it free, there still is a hair trigger alert in the region. And I hope that doesn't go away.
Miles O'Brien is a science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Miles.
You're welcome, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
True crime programs focused on overturning wrongful convictions or reopening cases that had questionable outcomes have been more common lately. That includes The Jinx on HBO and Making a Murderer on Netflix. Are there more cases like this, or simply an increased effort to find justice? And what goes into determining which situations are worth that effort? To learn more, I'm joined by Katie Pazauskas and Joey Dormady of ASU's Post-Conviction Clinic. Pazauskas is the former director of the Arizona Justice Project. And Katie, how do you narrow down which cases can be pursued?
Inmates apply to the Justice Project directly, or we hear about cases indirectly through lawyers, family members of the inmate, or friends of the inmate. Mm-hmm. But generally, the prisoner writes directly to the Arizona Justice Project. And then the project undergoes an initial screening process, which includes a preliminary questionnaire to undergo conflicts checks, and then a general questionnaire that is pretty extensive and asks a number of questions about the case, the issues in the case, what the inmate's claim is, what evidence may exist that can prove the claim. And if throughout that screening process there are specific issues that are identified that need further investigation, the intake lawyer at the Justice Project recommends that case to either a staff attorney at the Justice Project, the ASU Post-Conviction Clinic, the U of A Wrongful Conviction Clinic, or a local volunteer attorney.
And how much work in and of itself can that be?
There's a significant amount of work that goes into the initial screening process. It includes not only reviewing the prisoner's questionnaire, it includes looking at the trial record, all of the court pleadings, trial transcripts, sentencing documents, pretrial and trial motions, police reports, the exhibit list, appellate documents, post-conviction relief proceeding documents.
Mm-hmm. How rare is it for a wrongful conviction, especially one that may involve a death, how rare is it for that to be overturned?
Extremely rare. We're sometimes looking for a needle in a haystack. So just to give you some perspective.
But often you believe that needle's there based on having chosen this case.
Absolutely. Yes. Because the case goes through such a rigorous screening process and an intensive investigation, at the end of that, oftentimes you really do believe in that case if you're deciding to pursue it in court proceedings or before the Board of Executive Clemency.
I think there's a perception among, especially as we're seeing more sort of true crime programs out there, that there is something sort of glamorous about what it is that you guys do. And yet you wouldn't take a case based on emotion. You're professional attorneys. So
are people who view certain programs like we're seeing on Netflix or other programs, are we missing something by thinking not only it's glamorous, but also there's some emotional connection to the case as opposed to just thinking this was an injustice?
I'll tell you, there's nothing glamorous about the work. If there's a wrongfully convicted person serving time in prison for a crime they didn't commit, there's absolutely nothing glamorous about that. And there's nothing glamorous about spending years trying to find the evidence to prove that person's innocence. A lot of times we say we're in the trenches. I mean, we are looking for information. We're looking for people. We're looking for evidence. And there really is nothing glamorous about that.
I think the reason people get into this line of work, at least the reason I did, was you have this belief in the ideal of justice. So I can't think of many things that are more unjust than somebody who is innocent of a crime spending their life in prison or any amount of time in prison for something they didn't do. So it's hard to remove like that passion and that emotion toward that, you know, that you feel about that ideal.
What sort of impact do you think some of these TV programs are having? Is it a good thing because people are hearing more about wrongful convictions? Or in some cases, does it play up the drama in a sense that does something odd in terms of the actual position you guys have?
I think you encapsulated the nature of the double-edged sword. I mean, Making a Murderer right now, very popular, right? Now, at the beginning of that sequence of events, you see the impact of televised media kind of poisoning the jury pool a little bit, and people already speculating about who's been convicted or who did it, who didn't do it. But on the flip side of that coin, you also have the impact of the documentary itself, which is, you know, bringing issues like this to light. You know, like that documentary does a great job of pointing to a lot of issues that go to wrongful conviction, whether it be ineffective assistance of counsel, false confession, all that kind of stuff. It does a great job of highlighting that.
Does this raise awareness that there are more problems in the system than people thought, but then does it perhaps exaggerate the number of problems because people will see it on a TV show and think, oh my gosh, this is happening in 80% of cases?
I think what has come about with the 336 DNA exonerations across the country and with the additional 1,300 non-DNA exonerations across the country, we are now able to look at what went wrong in those cases and how can we fix the system and make it better to prevent a wrongful conviction from occurring. For instance, there are best practices for eyewitness ID procedures. So eyewitness misidentification is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions across the country. There are better ways in which to conduct an eyewitness identification that can reduce the number of misidentifications. And so there have been reform efforts sort of across the country to implement best practices when it comes to eyewitness ID procedures. And so there are other causes that have come up, you know, when looking at these cases. And I think it's just really given the criminal justice system something to think about and to improve upon.
Katie Pazauskas is supervising attorney for ASU's post-conviction clinic, and Joey Dormady is the clinic's program coordinator.
Water is such a precious resource in the Southwest that a lush lawn and bountiful garden can seem like a luxury. But as KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins explains, some Valley residents are finding ways to hydrate their landscape without tapping into groundwater.
You wouldn't know by the sound or look of the place that the home of Francis Peak and Lewis Powell is in the middle of the desert. Their central Phoenix home is alive with fountains, animals, and lush vegetation. But it wasn't always this way. When the brother and sister first moved to the home, it was like many in the valley. Not much greenery and no wildlife to speak of.
It was a different world, and since we've been here and planted trees, when you walk around our yard, you see lizards that you don't see otherwise, and you see birds, and we have dragonflies now, which I hadn't seen ever before.
Francis is a master gardener who knows how to grow things in the low desert.
A lot of people are under the impression that they can't grow anything because it's the desert, and that's totally untrue. In fact, in a sense, we have an even better growing season than anybody else because we can grow things in spring and fall.
Their backyard is a testament to what's possible. Opening the screen door from their kitchen, you feel as if you're entering into a different ecosystem. There's shade trees, vines, lots of ground cover, and flowers that attract insects and hummingbirds. But of course, all life needs water to survive. So instead of relying on an irrigation system, Francis and Lewis learned how to harvest their own water by taking classes with the Watershed Management Group. Lewis points out one of their first projects, a simple technique to control the flow of water in the yard.
We shaped shallow basins to retain the water and water the plants. After everything was planted, again, we put down the mulch over the top, which helps with weed suppression and helps maintain your moisture.
The next step was installing rain barrels to catch runoff from the roof.
In a good rain like we had last night, there's a waterfall coming off the roof right here. You put a barrel, it fills up fast.
In fact, if 1 inch of rain falls on a 1,000-square-foot roof, there's a potential to harvest almost 600 gallons of rainwater. Francis and Lewis also recycle the water from their washing machine to sustain a healthy orchard of peach, apple, apricot, and orange trees.
So the laundry water comes out, and then we have this valve box. We have three zones we can use. If I open this valve, the laundry water will water this basin with the fruit trees in it.
This project was a little more complex, but Watershed Management Group Program Coordinator Lindsay Ignatowski says there are even more opportunities around the house for water harvesting.
So if you wanted to take this further, you could do an outdoor shower that you use to bathe outside, send that water straight to your landscape. It's usually a super simple, very low-tech system. You can do a composting toilet.
While that may be outside the comfort zone for some, Ignatowski says water harvesting is a fulfilling way to garden and to live.
You know, you look at this and you think, this is a little bit different lifestyle, but then when you see it functioning, like, yeah, I could see myself living that way. It's a way of life that's really in harmony with our environment.
For the show, I'm Jimmy Jenkins in Phoenix.
The Watershed Management Group's water harvesting classes are taking place in Tempe next week.
Still to come, Gilbert's looking to build a new park, and it'll be a big one.
It takes a piece of property that would have sat there dormant and actually puts it to good use. And it's something that could be used by not only Gilbert residents, but, you know, the entire county.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark. I'm Steve. Quickly in Valley traffic, the 60 eastbound at Mill Avenue, that on-ramp is closed. Currently with relative humidity at 35%, partly cloudy, 58 degrees at KJZZ. At 2:36.
KJZZ is supported by the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust, celebrating a 26% decrease in dogs and cats entering local animal shelters since 2015. Details at nmpct.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Obama administration says it's halting new coal leases on federal lands until it completes a comprehensive review. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says after 30 years of operating under a system that called for getting as much coal out of the ground as possible, it's time for change.
It's time now to take a careful look at how we can strengthen our policies to best serve the needs and priorities of today.
At issue is whether fees charged to mining companies provide a fair return to taxpayers and reflect coal's impact on the environment. Roughly 40% of the coal produced in the U.S. comes from federal lands, primarily in Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico. In Hawaii, rescue teams continue their search for survivors after two military helicopters collided off the island of Oahu. Hawaii Public Radio's Bill Dorman reports a dozen people are missing.
As the sun rose over the waters off Oahu's north shore, rescue crews had already been at work for hours. A military spokesman says two Marine Corps Super Stallion helicopters collided during a training exercise late Thursday night, each with six crew members aboard. Local fire and rescue teams are working with military groups from the Navy and Coast Guard in searching a broad area. The debris field is widespread and expanding, and the search is complicated by a high surf warning with waves of up to 40 feet. For NPR News, I'm Bill Dorman in Honolulu.
A rare January hurricane in the Atlantic has weakened to a tropical storm after moving over the Azores, bringing high surf and strong winds. Tropical Storm Alex was the first hurricane to form in January since 1955. Energy and financial companies led stocks sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial closed down 390 points. NASDAQ was off 126 points. This is NPR.
Twenty-six drawings by one of the world's greatest artists made their way to Phoenix last week. They were escorted by a personal courier from Florence, Italy, packaged in crates, shipped in specialized trucks, and handled with gloves. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us behind the scenes as the rare drawings by Michelangelo are hung at the Phoenix Art Museum.
Through the main gallery, a guard lets us up a roped-off set of steps that lead up to the Lila and Joel Harnett Gallery in the Phoenix Art Museum.
The security on this is very intense, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, very intense.
There, Laura Wenzel greets me. She's the museum's registrar in charge of the exhibit's installation and care. The scene almost looks like a hospital room instead of a museum. A padded table is set up with spotlights shining on it. There's a box of rubber gloves sitting out, and a bright blue crate sits on the floor waiting to be unpacked.
After we unpack it, we put it here on the table where we've got lights to put on it so we can check every square inch of the piece to make sure that there's no condition changes from when it was seen the last time before it was packed and shipped.
On the gallery walls, the exhibit is taking shape. Renaissance master Michelangelo's drawings are hung, some covered in paper, so museum staff can test the light levels shining on them.
We record the light levels in a unit of measurement called a foot candle, or lux. We're trying to maintain 5-foot candles or lower, which is pretty dark, but that's because any kind of light damage is actually cumulative for the objects, and so the more exposure, the more chance for damage and discoloration and, you know, deterioration over time.
Even when they're behind glass in a frame like this?
Even when they're behind glass and in a frame.
And these drawings are 5 centuries old and particularly rare.
Only a little number of Michelangelo's drawings are still living.
Marcello Morongiu traveled here with these drawings from the Casa Buonarroti in Florence, Italy. And when I say traveled, I mean every step of the way, on the plane, and then in a specialized fine arts truck across the country from another museum in Nashville.
With fine art shipments, you have an exclusive use truck, so there's nothing else on the truck. You have 2 drivers, so if someone has to make a stop, then there's always someone to remain with the truck.
Along the way, she checks room temperature and humidity levels to make sure they're consistent.
In each move, we can't touch the original drawings, but only the frames.
And keeps a book to note any changes in the work's condition each time it's packed and shipped and then unpacked again.
Do you think that most people who come to the art museum and see an exhibit like this know how much has gone into just how they display it?
I think they have no idea.
In the exhibition, you'll see figure studies and architectural drawings by the artist. Morongiu says they show his process and his inspiration.
I wonder if you could show me your favorite drawing here.
Yes.
It's this one?
Yes.
It's a study of a male torso and an arm.
I love this drawing because we can find together 2 different sources of inspiration of the artist, but we can feel his sentiments, his emotion, and in the same time the study of classical art.
These drawings were done on paper, which is a living, breathing thing, Morongiu says. So after they are displayed for several months, she says they need to rest.
All of them are important and in their way beautiful.
To keep them intact, she'll take them back to the museum in Florence, where they'll sit for at least a year in a dark room out of their frames so the paper can breathe. Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Michelangelo's Sacred and Profane opens Sunday at the Phoenix Art Museum. You can see some of the images from this exhibit on our website, kjzz.org.
Gilbert is looking to build a new city park, and it's a big project. The town's proposal is for a 272-acre park south of Queen Creek Road and west of Higley Road. Officials are currently asking for feedback from residents. They could start to see some conceptual designs next month, and the park's first phase could open as early as the spring of 2019. Joining me to talk about the project is Rod Buchanan, director of Gilbert's Parks and Recreation Department. Rod, what is the plan for this park?
One thing that's exciting about this project is we were able to attain a lease agreement from the Flood Control District of Maricopa County, And it only costs $10 for the transaction. And what it allows for, it allows Gilbert to be able to construct and maintain and operate parks and related facilities to recreation. And what's important about it is that it takes a piece of property that would have sat there dormant and actually puts it to good use. And it's something that could be used by not only Gilbert residents, but, you know, the entire county.
What do you plan to put on that land?
Well, we haven't really planned to put anything at this point, and that's why we're doing this extensive community outreach. In early 2014, after this really extensive outreach effort, we adopted the Parks and Recreation and Trails Master Plan. In the plan, it did recommend that if we were able to get this property, we could develop this as a park in the south area of Gilbert. After the plan was adopted, we did a field needs analysis to see how many sports fields we really need in our community to be able to deliver activities for sports leagues and whatnot. And so we're going to the community and we're saying, okay, so we've identified all these needs and wants. So what do we put in this park to help deliver something that will be highly used?
Would it be fair to say that it'll be some combination of sports fields and sort of open space and playgrounds and that sort of thing? Are there other things that you're also considering?
Well, the outreach is happening and actually just started on Monday, the official outreach on the project. And so we have gotten a number of suggestions from community members, all the way from just strictly open space to highly amenitized sports fields.
So this is a really, really big parcel of land that we're talking about here. Even though the town didn't pay much to get access to it, I would imagine that maintaining it once it's built and even building it will be fairly expensive, right?
Well, the issue really is delivering parkland for your population at a certain service level. And so if we take that service level that we've had from the north half of our community over the years, and we apply that to our build-out estimated population number, we will need, according to our master plan, about another 300 to 400 acres of developed parkland to deliver that same service level. So the reason why this is actually less expensive to operate on an ongoing basis and actually to develop it is it's in lieu of a number of smaller parcels that we would most likely be required to build in order to meet that service level. And so the opportunities for economy of scales is apparent at this site in terms of it has per acre a lower cost point for maintenance. You can have your resources at one site versus four different sites for the same amount of acreage. And the opportunities there for these more diverse multi-use, because it's larger, can really be advantageous to have more visitors and actually generate revenue to help offset operational costs.
Rod Buchanan is the director of Gilbert's Parks and Recreation Department. Rod, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Highland High School in Gilbert has three new students this year, and they're not your typical high schoolers. The show's Annika Klein paid the school a visit.
Okay. Puppy, puppy, puppy! Ready?
Thanks! This is Tucson. She's a yellow female lab.
Arnetta, Tucson, and Vladimir are Highland High School's smallest, fuzziest students at just 13 weeks old.
Good girl.
And like the other students on campus, they're here to learn and prepare for a future career with a little help.
For me, this program isn't just, you know, I get a puppy and I get to raise and train it. Like, this is going to be somebody's lifeline someday.
Shelby Arrington and three other seniors at Highland are training these wiggly, waggy puppies to be guide dogs for people who are blind or have low vision.
Arnetta! Arnetta! Arnetta!
Vladimir! There you go. He's like, what?
The seniors are part of the National FFA organization, formerly known as Future Farmers of America, an agriculture and leadership program chartered in schools across the country. And the dogs come from Guide Dogs for the Blind, a California-based nonprofit.
The school setting is
a very ideal place to raise puppies.
Brent Ruppel is with Guide Dogs for the Blind.
There's a lot of activity, a lot of confusion going on there, a lot of people, a lot of different noises, and it helps prepare the dogs to be guide dogs.
They like this setting so much that about 100 puppies from Guide Dogs for the Blind are currently being trained by FFA students. That's an eighth of their total puppies in training. But these four seniors at Highland are the first in Arizona to participate in the partnership, overseen by Amy Dillard.
I teach vet science, and so this is part of the curriculum. They have to have taken animal science prior to this, so they have a little foundation in animal care.
And their knowledge shows. Liz Parra is one of the student trainers.
Nice! So you say nice and you give them their food, and then they learn positive reinforcement.
And a quick pop of the leash means no. It's tough to be strict to such a cute face. But Shelby Arrington says obedience is super important for their future jobs. And so is knowing when not to obey.
So basically, like, if their handler's asking them to walk across the street and there's cars coming, you know, she needs to be able to say, I'm not going to listen right now because you'll get hit by a car if we actually go.
Bottom of the kennel. Good boy! Good boy!
Clearly there's chemistry in this classroom between the students and dogs. And Briar Lopez says it'll be tough to let them go at the end of the training. But seeing them succeed will be worth it.
You want them to go to campus and you want them to pass through all eight levels of training, and then you want them to go on to graduate and be able to hand them off to somebody who's going to use them for the rest of their lives.
But for about the next 15 months, the dogs will stay with the Highland seniors, which means come August, they might embark on another adventure together, college. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
And good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, accidents to watch out for on the 60 eastbound at Rural. That one's blocking the left lane. Also, the shoulder's blocked by a collision on the 202 eastbound at Alma School. We'll stay partly cloudy tonight with overnight lows around 40 degrees. Partly cloudy again tomorrow with a high of 63. With relative humidity at 35%, it's partly cloudy, 58 degrees at 250.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering a gourmet game plan with gridiron subs, party platters, USDA prime steaks, fresh-made guacamole, and craft beers. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
A week-long bus strike in Phoenix is coming to an end after lengthy negotiations between the Transit Union and Transdev, the city-contracted bus service. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger joins me. And Lauren, what's the latest on this?
Well, hundreds of Phoenix bus drivers just voted on a tentative deal between the two parties that they agreed upon early this morning. After union members have been on strike for a week, they just announced the result of that vote, and the strike is officially over. Drivers will return to work tomorrow, and all routes will resume their normal schedules moving forward.
These talks have been going on for quite a while. What was behind all this?
Well, for months, the union had been threatening to strike, and last week they finally did. And this has affected a lot of Phoenix residents, tens of thousands of people. Transdev operates 34 of the city's most heavily used routes, about 60% of Phoenix's bus service, actually. The disagreements have been about a host of issues, including bereavement time, a tiered payment system, and having clean and safe restrooms for drivers. Now, throughout all of this, Mayor Stanton has pushed the two sides to keep talking, and today he says he's pleased they've been able to find some common ground.
What was it in this deal that made it finally go through that the union could support?
Well, we don't have all of the details yet, but it was an 85% vote in favor of the deal today. It sounds like workers are getting some of what they wanted when it comes to phasing out a tiered payment system, and they're getting an increase in bereavement leave.
So bus service set to return to normal tomorrow. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The mascot has been an iconic symbol for decades, and there's a story behind how it was brought to life. The show's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez has more.
Sparky, the Sun Devil logo, was created after World War II and was developed into a performing mascot a few years later. Did you know a state legislator once claimed he was the first Sparky until a man came forward and proved his acrobatic skills brought the mascot to life?
In the fall of 2000, I noticed in the Arizona Republic a statement by
the state legislator Gary Richardson that he was the first performing Sun Devil.
Robert Spindler is head of the ASU Archives and Special Collections Department.
I thought it was interesting that he had made the claim. And when I got to work later that morning, I received a phone call from a gentleman named Dick Jacobs, who said that Richardson's claim was incorrect.
Spindler was aware the legislator wore a Sparky costume when he was a boy during a football game in the late 1950s, but wasn't sure the lawmaker was the first performing Sun Devil. So he invited Jacobs to the campus to show his evidence. Spindler remembers when the elderly man walked in with a box. It held several items, including a scrapbook. The photos highlighted his time as a student from 1951 to 1953, when the school was Arizona State College. At the time, Jacobs was also a competitive gymnast. Scanning his computer, Spindler shows me the black and white photos.
There's the Sun Devil, Dick Jacobs, up at the top of the goalpost in what's clearly Goodwin Stadium.
Jacobs is dressed in a thin satin-like costume with horns and a tail, his face exposed. Many of the photos are of him doing acrobatic stunts. Other interesting photos here show Sparky had partners.
The Sparkettes, as they were known, started, I believe, in 1952, based on the dates on the photographs.
Spindler says proof shows Jacobs was likely the first Sparky on the field. He hasn't found any data of someone taking over for Jacobs after he finished school. But there is that costume former state legislator Gary Richardson wore as a boy in 1958.
Richardson's Sparky costume, which is on display at the Tempe History Museum, you'll see he was very short, and so it's very likely he could have a legitimate claim to be the youngest performing Sun Devil.
The Sparky costume has changed over the years, including adding a mask. Spindler says ASU keeps the identity of those who wear the mascot costume secret, so much so that he's only identified about half a dozen people who have worn Sparky through the year 2000. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we should know, please tell us about them. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
There are some songs that evoke such strong memories that when we hear them, we're immediately transported to a different place and time. It can be a pivotal moment in our lives, a memory of joy or heartache, or just a point in the continuum of life that may have defined us. It's the time machine. Let's go. Today we take a ride with KJZZ's Sarah Ventry.
In 2010, I got an internship with All Songs Considered at NPR, and it was super exciting, and it meant that I needed to move to Washington.
There is a crow moon coming in where you keep looking now.
So I packed up my things. I moved to D.C. on Labor Day weekend in September, the beginning of September. In the evenings, I would take the metro to the Pentagon and then take a bus from the Pentagon into my neighborhood. And it was about a two-hour commute each way.
An old machine was abandoned by the ancient races then.
The commute became very exhausting. But the commute was also, in some ways, this really gorgeous, amazing tour of D.C. and this amazing introduction to the area. We would drive over the Potomac. We would drive past the Kennedy Center. And there's this spot, this really, really gorgeous spot on 7th Street in D.C., where if you're standing on the street, you're exactly halfway between the Capitol Building and the Washington Monument. And for me, it was this, like, gorgeous, like, urban experience. As the months went on, like, the weather got colder and colder, and it was my first East Coast fall and my first East Coast winter. And I grew up in Arizona, and I didn't even own a coat when I moved to D.C. And the first winter is, like, so hard when you go to a cold place.
I left my heart to the wild hunter coming. I live until the call.
and I plan to be forgotten when I'm gone. Yes, I believe it in the fall.
I was also being introduced to all of this new music from people that I worked with. So I was introduced to this musician who goes by the name The Tallest Man on Earth. He's this really interesting kind of modern folk musician who has a very, very distinct voice and sort of writes these really, really poignant songs that have kind of sharp, biting lyrics. And I found this really analogous to the fall time. And the air felt like sharp and kind of cold. And his lyrics somehow felt new but also familiar. And I just found myself listening to this album a lot on my commute, especially on the way home in the evening.
And I plan to be forgotten when I'm gone.
And there was something that was a little bit bittersweet about it, that was a little bit melancholy about it. There was some sense of optimism to it, but also a sense that you're leaving other things behind. And there was something so comforting about hearing this song, and I still to this day associate that song with the fall.
Yes, I believe it in the fall.
And when the air gets like a little bit cooler, I find myself always wanting to pull out that album and take a listen to it.
You've heard our time traveling tales. Now we want to hear from you. Is there a song that takes you back? Let us know on Twitter with the hashtag KJZZTimeMachine, on our Facebook page, or at the show at kjzz.org. And we'll pick one listener to take over the controls for the next installment of The Time Machine.
And as you get prepared for the weekend, you might want to check out Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Coming up tomorrow night at 7:30 at the MIM in Phoenix.
Also, ASU men's basketball team will be taking on Washington tomorrow afternoon, late afternoon, early evening, ASU Wells Fargo Arena in Tempe.
And this is coming up later this afternoon. Not going to encourage this one, Mark. Dodgeball party for kids.
That's dangerous. 3-4.
Yeah, we don't really want to encourage injury. It's sport ball in Scottsdale.
Also, Revival, the improv, will be taking place tomorrow night at Space 55 in Phoenix.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Valle. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. The managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director is Al Macias, and our executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. You can reach us at theshow at kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next on KJZZ. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and a 100% online option. Details about the Tuesday, January 19th info session are at ellermba.com.